Okay, so we're going to talk about Achdus, which is one of the first chapters in the book Pele Yoetz. And what I'm going to do, I have the text for you, for those who like to follow the text inside. I'm not going to read word for word, line by line. What I'm going to do is basically summarize his ideas the way he presents them in a translation into English. And I'm going to focus on some sentences where I'll read it out loud. And if you want, you can underline it or so. I have an extra pen here if anybody needs one. He says the following, that there are certain pillars, he says, which are necessary in order for the earth to be populated properly, in order for everything on earth in society to be organized properly. And the one thing that you need for any organization, if you want it to work properly, if you want the system to be well oiled, is got to be Achdus. It's got to be a unification. He calls it a tikkun ha'olam. That's the way we establish the world. And Hashem, he says, gets a special nachas ruach, a special pleasure, if you will. Correct. A spiritual kind of divine pleasure. He gets benefit from the fact that he sees people cooperating and harmonizing together. And he has a medrash here, which I couldn't find anywhere. I looked for it, but we'll rely on him. He's probably not misquoting the medrash. The medrash says, on the pasuk in Iyov, that pasuk I can find for you, v'hu, referring to God, be echad. And what does it mean, be echad? So the medrash says that God declares that my Shechina will only reside when there's echad, when there's achdus, when there's unity. And beyond that, the Chazal have a pasuk in Hosea, and based on this pasuk, it says in Hosea that even if the Jewish people are worshipping idols, that's how low they've gotten, nevertheless, they can be protected from harsh judgment because of Achdus. So let's just summarize what we see here, the three points that he's making. Point number one is that the Tikkun HaOlam, the world itself, in order to function properly in a well-oiled system, must have Achdus. Point number two is that when people cooperate and they work in harmony, Hashem gets a special pleasure from that. And point number three is that the Shekhinah will only reside in a place where there is Achdus. When there's no Achdus, then Shekhinah is gone. The Shekhinah can't tolerate.
That's a terrible statement. The Shekhinah is never ever.
Okay. We're on the negative side, but hopefully we'll get on the positive side as well. Now, I want to share with you a few things on this opening introduction of the Pele Yoetz. First of all, in terms of this concept of cooperation, the last page that you may be able to find in your handout is from a book that was written by none other than my father, may rest in peace. The name of the book is called Good Beginnings, and it's a book of sermons, of drashos, on the Parshas HaShavua. So it should look like this if anybody's interested. Okay, if you have it. It's called Bo, Parshas Bo, and it's called The Sense of Community. This is what the original looks like. Somebody told me that there's one copy still left on Amazon.com. I don't know if that's true or not. Okay, this book was published in 1963, so we're going back a while. And it's based on the Pesach, the Korban Pesach. The Korban Pesach requires what we call a chabura, or a unit. People join together on one lamb. They, so to speak, register. And if they register on one lamb, they could all eat on the night of Pesach from that lamb. And this idea of partnering in one unit for the Pesach is symbolic of what the Jewish religion is all about, and it undermines the Egyptian attitude towards life. The Egyptian attitude in society is Ish lo ra es achav. You may remember that the next to the last makkah, which is makas choshesh, the Torah says that a brother didn't see a brother. And basically, the Egyptian attitude was one of selfishness. I care about myself. That's the affliction of Mitzrayim. No man saw his own brother. and he quotes a little ditty, he calls it, poem, and this typifies the attitude of the Egyptian society. I had a little tea party this afternoon at 3, which was very small, 3 guests in all, just I, myself, and me. Myself ate all the sandwiches, while I drank up the tea, 'twas also I who ate the pie and passed the cake to me. That's the Egyptian attitude. It's basically me, myself, and I. And he says that Judaism fights against this selfish attitude. The sitter, every single prayer that we have is formulated in the plural. We're always asking out of a sense of community for our needs. Not my needs. I'm not just saying I, me, or mine. I'm saying we, our, and ours. And I think in Spanish it's ustedes, if I remember from my high school. Ustedes. Yeah, I can't pronounce it the way I should be pronouncing it, but that's because my Spanish teacher in high school was just one lecture ahead of us. That's all he knew about Spanish. Anyway, he says that if you look into the world of physics, you'll find this a very fascinating phenomenon. It was the plan of creation built into the law of physics that everything lives in pairs. Only God is one. Take, for example, if you want to have water, you have to combine oxygen and hydrogen. If you want to get salt, you have to combine sodium and chlorine. And this goes on and on. In fact, certain metals, when they fuse with other metals, you get steel, and this is basically the sinewy cause of modern industry. But he says that even in the biological world, we know that there were big living creatures that inhabited the earth. They're called dinosaurs. And these animals perished. And scientists say that the reason they perished is because they ate each other up. There was such a hatred. And he says that the bees and the ants, they get together in a community and they are thriving to this day. There's a famous story about the lion and the nightingale. The lion wanted to prove to all the animals of the forest that it's the king of the forest. And the lion let out a gigantic roar and all the animals fled. And even the trees were shaking, right? And the nightingale started singing and all the animals came together. So which is more powerful, the king, the lion, or the song of this? He says the following. This is not in your page because I ran out of paper here, but he tells a legend about a man who died. He was a great man, and he reached the other world, and they gave him a tour. So first they gave him a tour of the other side. We'll call it Gehenna, okay? And he was surprised. He finds people sitting around colorful banquet tables, loaded with appetizing food, appealing to the eye, to the palate, but they all look starved and emaciated. And then they took him to the other side, and people were really looking great. So when he asked the angel, what's the difference? He says the following. We tied long spoons to their hands. In Gehenna, no one could manage with the large spoons to get even a morsel of food into their mouth. When he asked, but the same arrangement I saw in the good place in heaven.
Yeah, they were feeding each other.
Exactly, the people were seated at banquet tables. They were well fed and happy. And the angel explained, "Here, my friend, people have learned to feed one another." And that's why it's heavenly here. So this is the idea of Judaism. That's why we have so much emphasis, he says, on Tefillah B'Tzibur. We come together, we daven together in a quorum. And he says that there was once a case of a man who stopped coming to shul. He used to come every week for Shabbos. So the rabbi inquired about him, thinking maybe he was ill. And he found out that he was healthy. So one evening the rabbi went to visit him. And he found the member of his shul seated comfortably near the fireplace. So the rabbi walked over to the fireplace. And what he did was he picked up tongs and he took off from the fireplace. He removed a live piece of charcoal, of coal. They both sat and watched as this charcoal, which was warm and glowing, now became cold and dead. The rabbi said nothing. He arose, he bade his neighbor good night, and went home. And the next Shabbos, the man returned to shul. He had gotten the message. As long as the chakals are together in one community as an achdus, then we can succeed and we can be a tzibur. I want to share with you a few insights of the Chassam Sofer. You know that the Peleoids lived over 2 centuries ago. The Chassam Sofer lived about 150 years ago. And this you'll find on the 3rd page of your handout. Well, actually, I have the original, so it's the 3rd page. In your case, I think it should be the 2nd page, right? Because you have a double-sided, correct? So anyway, it'll look something like this, if you find it. Again, it's not necessary to see the text, because hopefully I'll be able to share it with you without the text. The Chassam Sofer, again, his name was Sofer. He lived 150 years ago in Germany. I'm sorry, in Hungary, I meant to say. And he says the following. That there's one phenomenon in society, one negative attribute, which undermines Parnassa. And that, he says, is machlokes. He says when there's no unity, then there's miut Parnassa. It limits the amount of livelihood that we're going to get. He goes as far as to say that when Yaakov Avinu declares, and this is in Parshas Vayigash, he says, Vayetze ha'echad mi'iti, he's referring, of course, to Yosef who left, va'omar ach torov toraf. Now, the Chassam Sofer sees myriads of symbolic messages here in this pasuk. Literally, if you translate the pasuk, it means that I lost my son, he's no longer around, he was eaten up by a live animal. But on a deeper level, if you take the words to have symbolic meaning, it means something totally different. Vayetze ha'echad mi'iti, one of my sons is outside of the cooperation and the brotherhood of the society of his 11 brothers because they rejected him. The word tarof or teref means not just to be ripped apart, but it means to support someone. In other words, a financial base for Parnassa. And now, what Yaakov Avinu is declaring is that once the unity and the brotherhood of the Shvatim was destroyed, was undermined by Vayetze Echad Meiti, when Yosef was rejected, as a result, Tarov Taraf, Nitrifa Hamizonos Hakoyri Tera, it's going to undermine the possibility of having a solid financial base. And he concludes his presentation with a pasuk in Tehillim. The pasuk says, "Hasam gvulech shalom, chelev chitim yasbiech." David HaMelech declares that if there's peace, if there's harmony, then chelev chitim will be able to have satiation in all our needs. So the Chassam Sofer is certainly adding another element into this equation. Let's go back to the Peleoids that we started with. The Peleoid says that even if the Jewish people are guilty of the most severe of sins, which sin would that be in this context? Avodah Zarah. Nevertheless, God overlooks the Midas Hadin, meaning meeting out punishment, and He has mercy, and He protects the people of Israel. And I was really fascinated by this idea.
As long as what happened?
I'm sorry, I left out the punchline. Thanks, Yossel, for pointing out. As long as there is Achdus, as long as they're working together in tandem.
In Avodah Zarah.
Well, again, I'm not saying that they're working together in Avodah Zarah per se, but it means to say that if there's peace and harmony amongst the Jewish nation, people are not fighting, there's no machlokes, then God will protect them even if they're guilty of the most severe sins. Even a chet like the chet ha'egel. And I was perplexed by this. Where does the, you know, it, with all due respect, you know, I teach the Peleoids because I think that he's great. But where does he come off saying such a thing? It sounded to me to be way too revolutionary, way too radical of an idea. So I found in a sefer called the Meshech Chochmah. Yossele, help me out here. Who authored the Meshech Chochmah?
The guy who wrote the Shomer of, what's his name?
Rameh.
Or Sameach.
Yossele, Rameh Simcha Mitzvah.
Rameh Simcha Mitzvah.
So Rav Meir Simcha came from a town in Lithuania called Dvinsk. I was in that area, and they told me that there's no town called Dvinsk. They call it Dagopils. So that's what the Lithuanians call it. But anyway, we called it Dvinsk. There was another great giant in the same city at the same time. That was the Rogachover. In any event, you may be able to find a page that looks like this. It'll say on the top right, Dovev Meisharin, for those who enjoy seeing the text inside. It's towards the, I would say, the middle of this little booklet that I prepared for you. And I put a lot of work putting this together because I'm not into photocopying and all that stuff, but I was able to do it. Says Rav Meir Simcha Mitvinsk, if we study the Torah carefully, we find a very paradoxical phenomenon. And that is that the punishments for what he calls actions, criminal actions, he gives a few examples, immorality or idolatry, are punished by the most severe punishments that you could imagine. He introduces kares, skila, other mises based, and basically these are capital crimes. And if a person is condemned in a court of law and all the conditions are met, he will be put to death. And yet, paradoxically, when we get to a whole list of other criminal actions, and it's an enumerated long list, he calls them nimusiot umidot, meaning if a person is guilty of lashon hara, of machlokes means when he breaks up the unity, rechilus, you know, he speaks badly and negatively about a person, passing on stories about him, theft, you know what's common to all these nimusios? There's no punishment. Ein bo malchus, ein bo mises bezdin, we don't give him lashes, we don't put him to death. That's only half the story, says the Rav Meir Simcha. That only applies in the case of the yachid, in the case of the individual. If the individual is guilty of crimes like idolatry and immorality, the punishment is severe. But if the individual is guilty of moral violations, almost no punishment at all, at least in a Jewish court of law. But that's only as far as the individual is concerned. What if the society, what if the community as a whole is guilty of these sins? Here he says it's punfakert, it's all just the opposite. He says the following, Zedafka biyochid hose, avlimat sibur nishchosim, if the people as a group, as a community, are guilty of scandals, of all sorts of immorality between man and fellow man, here the punishment is of the highest and most severe order. And in order to demonstrate this, he invokes a Yerushalmi, a Talmud Yerushalmi, a Masech Depeah. And Yerushalmi says the following, Doro shel David, at the time of David HaMelech, Kulam Tzadikim Hayu. The people were very righteous in the ritual area. They were very meticulous about the observance of the Torah and the Halacha. However, they were punished and many of them died in battle. And why? Because Hayu Bahem Diltorin. Diltorin is an Aramaic word for negative slander and speech. They were guilty of slander and speech and they died in the battlefield. Avodoro shel Achav. Now you may remember that there was a king called Achav who was a very rotten king, and he perpetrated the worst of crimes, including Avodah Zarah. And yet, they didn't die in the battle. Menatzchim, during all the military campaigns at the time of Achav, the Jewish people were always victorious to the extent that there were no casualties on the battlefield. We can only hope for that today. Again, we hope there's not going to be a war, but according to what Lieberman said, it's just a matter of time. But anyway, so what happened over here? What was going on at the time of Achav? This was a dar, this was a generation that was absolutely guilty of idol worship. And the answer is, lo hayo bahem diltorin. They didn't speak negatively, derogatorily, one to the other. And as a result, God protected them, and there were no casualties in battle. Could you imagine? The same Jew went out to battle after he worshipped an idol. And he went out with his buddies, and they were somehow close. You know, there was a brotherhood, there was a unity amongst them. And they didn't speak negatively one about the other. And Hashem said, I'm going to protect you. You're no good idol worshiper, but I'm going to protect you, and you're going to come back safe and sound. So for the same sin, which the individual, if he was judged and condemned, he would be punished with a capital punishment, and yet if it's the tzibur that's guilty, nevertheless, God is going to be with them and protect them. And he invokes a pasuk in Parshas Achrimos. The Torah says, Hashochein itam betoch tumosam, that God resides with them even when they are in a state of tumah. What kind of tumah are we talking about? We're not talking about contracting tumah by defiling yourself with contact with the dead. Here we're talking about tumas, arayos, tumas, avodah zarah. This is a corrupting and filthy kind of sin, but yet God is still with them. Why is God with them? And the answer is the Yerushalmiyan Peah. The Yerushalmiyan Peah says that God is with them, even in their state of corruption, because they are close together, and they form a unit. Benimusios ubemidos lachinor machlokes, anything that has to do with machlokes and divisiveness, that's something that Hashem says I cannot tolerate. And the pasuk in Tehillim says, Ruma al Hashamayim kaviyochol salek shchinascha mehem, God removes his protective shchina from the Jewish people if they're guilty of machlokes. And therefore he says that in our time, he's describing the year 1890 about, approximately, Chil Shabbos, he says, Bavanoseinu Arab Nispashet, there is widespread violation of the Shabbos. And therefore, we have to worry about a punishment. He says, it all depends on how they get along one with the other. If the Jewish people, despite their low level of Shabbos observance, are able to be unified, then God will push off, he'll stave off punishment. It's Hashochein Itam B'toch Tumasim, God is there to protect them. But if, heaven forbid, they're not only guilty of Shabbos violation, but they're also guilty of Nimusios, of the Bein Adam L'Chaveiro, you know, the ethical area, oh then, Holchim B'Charevos V'Chitzim, he describes the punishment for the Jewish people that's going to be severe, Nakom Yinkom Hashem.
That this says the death of the 24,000 students fall under this rubric.
Excellent. Excellent. Wow, Phoebe. I don't know why I didn't think of it. Brilliant, brilliant point. Can I just say over what you say and then you'll ask your question?
No. I'm just that
Phoebe is quoting a Gemara in Yevamos that says that Rabbi Akiva lost 24,000 students. And why? Shedibru Lashon Hara. Or Lochibdu Zed Zed. There was no unity. Each person was out for his own self and he thought he was great. And everything revolves around myself. It's me, myself, and I philosophy. That's the Egyptian philosophy. Lora Ish Ezakiv. And that's why they died. Because as a tzibur, they couldn't be protected, even if they were meticulous about their learning and their Torah, if they didn't have that cooperation, that spirit.
Because they didn't respect one another. Therefore, they were not cohesive.
There was no cohesive form because they didn't respect one another.
Does he have an operational image, a time, a place, when there was achdus?
Well, for sure, the door of Achav, could you imagine? The Yerushalmi claims...
There was no Achav. Achav was running after the...
So I don't know. I'm just telling you what the Yerushalmi says. You want to say it's not so.
I want to try to see how he bolsters an argument with some...
And I'm telling you, again, I didn't live at the time of Achav, so we can fight back and forth. Hopefully we respect each other in the battle, vehemently arguing, as Sita would say. But that's what Yishalmi says. Yishalmi says, how could it be that during David's time, so many soldiers died in the battlefield, and yet during Achav's time, which is the time of Avodah Zarah, people lived and they survived, and they went out to battle in the same dangerous situations, and they were protected. So this is the Yerushalmi, this is Rabbi Simcha, and now we have the Peleoids who's saying the same thing. I'll read to you the language of the Peleoids. He says, "Afilu imheim ovdim avodah zarah kishehem biachtus." If they have mutual respect as idol worshippers, idol worshippers can also have mutual respect. Ein midas hadin yecholo lishlot b'hem. That's a very heavy statement. And again, if I only had the Peleoids, I would say maybe he's exaggerating a little bit. But now that I saw the Yerushalmi, the way that the Rebbe Simcha presents it, in the paradox that although on a personal, individual level, you'll get, the punishment is very severe for Avodah Zarah, but on a communal level, the question is, how are we getting together? And is there cooperation?
Let's go back to the golden calf. There is a significant unity of people who worship the golden calf. Put aside the women, put aside the tribe of Levi, but there was a significant unity of male participation in the worship of the golden calf. And it ended up that 3,000 of them
perished,
died, right, at the hands of
Levi, Shem, Levi.
Right? So that seems to run contrary to what the Yerushalmi is talking about in later eras. Right?
So what's the difference between the case of the Yerushalmi, which is a battlefield, and the case of Shevet Levi with regard to the worshippers of the eagle? Do you remember exactly who Levi chose to kill by sword? There was a judicial process. Every individual whose life was taken stood in judgment in front of a court. Two witnesses had to testify. So that's what Rabbi Meir Simcha Mitvinsk is saying, that when we're judging the individual will be put to death. We have no mercy. That's what the Torah requires.
Even though they are part of a unified group,
doesn't matter. That unified group is not going to help you. Unified group is going to help you when there's some sort of divine plan in which God has to enter into the picture and decide, are we going to win the battles or are we going to lose the battles? It's between us and our enemies.
Or you can win the battle, and David won the battles, but you still, like in most ordinary battles, suffered.
But there was
people in his armies who got killed.
But there was an unusual amount of people who got killed. In fact, the Pasuk says in Divrei Hayamim that the reason why David was denied his goal in life, his dream in life, is because so many people were killed at his hands. And you should know that David HaMelech, okay, this is going to be way beyond our discussion tonight, he went out to battle not just to defend what we call self-defense.
Defensive wars.
He went out for offensive wars, to expand the boundaries of the land of Israel. For example, there's something called Aram Tzova, which he conquered even before the land of Israel itself was conquered. That's called in halachic terms Milchemes Rishus. That's a voluntary war. And as a result, many Jews lost their lives. But where was the divine protection of the Shekhinah? And Achav is an amazing miracle. Achav? My gosh. He's like the last guy in the world that I would think should be a candidate for this great miracle of protecting his soldiers.
He hit all the big three spots. Gileosh, Yelazdam, and
yeah, he was pretty bad. My friends, I want to share with you an insight of the great Rosh Yeshiva of the Mir Yeshiva. This you'll find on the same page that you opened before, but just on the left side of the page. This is called Sichot Musar. Does anybody know which great Rosh Yeshiva, the Mir Yeshiva, I'm referring to? Rav Chaim Shmulevitz. There's a Gemara in Masechta Nedarim, which, if I could use the phrase, tickles his brain. He can't figure out what the Gemara means. The Gemara says that there are four categories of individuals who are considered dead in their lifetime. One of them is a mitzora, someone who's struck with leprosy. Again, leprosy is a very bad translation of the word tzaras, but just for the purpose of going on. The second person on the list is an ani, a poor person. Why is he considered dead? a suma, a blind person, and finally mishein lo banim, someone who doesn't have children. Very difficult to begin to understand what is the common denominator between these four categories, such that the Gemara puts them all together, and each of them, all of them, are called kimeis. So Chaim takes a stab at this. You know, if I would have thrown in the towel and said it, I admit defeat. But he wants to explain it, and he wants to say the following: it's going to require of us to redefine life. And he says the following. Let's take the case of a suma, a blind person. If I were to ask you the following question, give me a knee-jerk response. Who's worse off, a blind person or a deaf person? What would be your answer?
Blind person.
I would have said a blind person, 100%. Helen Keller, one of the greats of all time, the great women of all time, was both
deaf
and blind. She was an incredible woman.
Deafness is a blessing at times.
I know what you mean. Like turn down the hearing aid, right? So Reb Chaim Shmuel Levitz has a Gemara to prove. Are you ready to fight this one, Yasala? That the deaf person is in worse shape than the blind person. How could that be? How does he prove it? First of all, the Gemara says the following. This is a perek in tort law, in Baba Kama. You know, tort law means that you can force a person, compel a person to pay, to compensate you for damages under very strict, you know, conditions. But, well, you know, for that you'd have to learn half of Masechta Baba Kama. So the Gemara establishes the following. Charsho, if you bop a person over the ear, or the Gemara has cases where you scare him and you blow a shofar in his ear, whatever the cases may be, and he becomes deaf, is no se lo to make kulo. You have to pay a full compensation. There's no mercy whatsoever. In the case of a suma, however, the halacha is a little bit more, shall I say, compassionate. If you cause the person blindness, then you have to pay the value of the eyes. Again, we have to know what that means, but as opposed to making someone deaf, where you pay for the value of the person as a whole. So you evaluate how much he'd be worth as a slave, and then now he's deaf and he doesn't get a job, and so forth and so on. So Chaim Shmuel Levitz wants to say the following. You get the impression from the Gemara that the cheresh is worse off than the suma. The deaf person is worse off than the blind person. That's why the Torah is more strict and more harsh on the damager who generated deafness to a person. And yet, in the four categories that we find here, which one do we find is considered kemes? Only the suma, the blind person, the deaf person doesn't appear on the list. Why is that so? And he says the following. That if you evaluate something in terms of hefsed, which means loss, then the loss of hearing is a very severe damage. However, that doesn't mean that a deaf person is kemes. A blind person is kemes. He's considered like a dead person. Why? So Reb Chaim introduces another element into the equation. And he says the following. This is the paragraph that starts Achen, if anybody wants to see it inside. Hare'iya, the power of sight, even though it's not more significant to a person than the power of hearing, the ability to hear, nevertheless, sight is crucial for one thing. I mean, more than one thing, but one thing in our context. The ability to identify, to empathize with someone else. You can hear all sorts of things about a person's plight, never. But you won't identify with that person unless you see the person with your eyes. That's why the Torah emphasizes that Moshe Rabbeinu's heart fell down when he went out and he saw the plight of his brothers. The Pasuk says, Vayigdal Moshe, Moshe became mature. Vayetze el achav, he went out to see his brethren. Vayar besivlosom, says Reb Chaim Shmulevitz, emphasize the word vayar. And Rashi points it out. He says, Nosan Enov, he saw, he put his eyes on the people, he saw how they were being beaten up. Vilibo, and then his heart responded, Lios Miyatzer Aleim, he identified with that sorrow. And therefore, says Reb Chaim, although in terms of a person's overall function, maybe hearing is absolutely critical, but it doesn't play the same role when we touch upon identifying with the zulat, with the next person. And he suggests the following, that when the pasuk tells us about Yaakov Avinu at the end of his life, this is at the end of Sefer Bereishis in Vayechi, it says, V'einei Yisrael kovdu mizoken, lo yuchal liros, he couldn't see the brothers, his own children, V'yageshal sameilav, he had them approach him, V'yishak lehem v'yichabek lehem, and he kissed them and he hugged them. So the Sfarno, one of the great commentaries from 5 centuries ago from Spain, he says the following, why did Yaakov Avinu feel compelled to kiss and hug his brothers? And the answer is because he didn't have the ability to see them. His eyesight was gone, and therefore he had to find a substitute to be dovek nafsho bohem, to absolutely cling to their souls, so that now, out of that sense of love, he could bestow the blessing upon them. This is the situation of a blind person. Hatam, the reason, says Reb Chaim Shulevitz, Shasuma Choshev Kemes, Ki Belo Chush HaReiyah, the absence of the ability to see, Ein Adam Misugal LaHargish Et Zulato, he doesn't have the capacity to feel the pain of the next one. Ulishtatef Imo B'matzavo, and to give a shoulder, so to speak, how would you say it? Latet katef, we say in modern Hebrew, to share his burden with him. As a result, a person who's blind, if he cannot identify and empathize with others, who sharui levado ba'olam, he lives in a lonely world, alone. Chashiv kemes. Misa here, says Reb Chaim Shlomitz, means loneliness. Anyone who's not part of society, who cannot relate to society, cannot be part of the community, he's chashiv kemes. Says Reb Chaim, that's the common denominator that links together these 4 categories. The Mitzora is sent, chutz migimel machnos, he has to be rejected and quarantined outside of society. He lives therefore alone. Badad yeshev, bididut means loneliness, and therefore he's chashiv kemes. And misha elo banim, someone who never has no children, he cannot give to his children, he cannot share with them, even though he may have all the pleasures of life and all the funds and possessions and wealth and so forth and so on. But the nature of man, he says, by his very essence, is lehetiv. He wants to give to others. He wants to identify with others. And primarily, first and foremost, with his children. And an ani, a poor person also, is not able to give of his own because he doesn't have. This, my friends, I think, is the introduction to Parshas Yisro. And I'd ask you now, if you can, to turn to a page that looks like this. And it'll say on top, why Yisro came. Do you have it?
Yes.
You know that there's a tremendous controversy. It says, Vayishma Yisro, Yisro heard, and then he came to join the Jewish community. What exactly did he hear? The pasuk itself, if you take it kipshuto, straightforward, seems to indicate he heard about Yitzias Mitzrayim. Right? Because if you open up to the Chumash, again, I don't have a Chumash in front of me this second, but it says that he heard all that God had done for Moshe and for Yisrael.
There's a Chumash right here.
You want to do me a favor and open up to the first pasuk in Shmos Perek Yud Ches, and it should say over there that Hashem took the people out of Mitzrayim. And yet, at least according to one opinion, which Rashi quotes on the spot, that's not what he heard about. He heard about the splitting of the Amsuf, and he heard about the battle against Amalek. So Rashi must have felt, again, Rashi standing on the shoulders of Chazal, that these nisim v'niflos, you know, the fact that the Jewish people, unarmed, so to speak, were able to fight and defend, hold their own against Amalek, or the fact that the Amsuf was able to split at the right moment, these were such powerful miracles that Yisroel felt he's got to come forward and join the Jewish people and thank God. You remember that Yisroel recites a blessing. However, my father, Zichron Levracha, wants to know that even though these two miracles are great miracles, why is that any greater than taking the Jewish people out of Mitzrayim? There were 10 plagues, the last of which was the destruction of the Bechoros, and then the Jewish people left Mitzrayim. I mean, that wouldn't be enough. Boy, the Chazal feel compelled, oh, we've got to look back, Kriyas Yamsuf, we got to find Melchemes Hamolek. And my father tries in a very original way to find a common denominator between these two great miracles. Joe, did you find the pasuk?
Jethro, the minister of Midian. The
oh, the English I have here in front of me. No, I was hoping you'd read it in Hebrew.
God did. Oh, you have it written?
Yeah, I have it here in English, so I want to go back to...
Taking the people out of Egypt.
Correct.
But the preceding... Parsha ends with Amalek. So that is perhaps the junction.
Right. But again, the pasuk says explicitly that he heard that God took us out of Mitzrayim. It doesn't say that he came because of Amalek.
It doesn't say anything about Amalek, except that this sentence, this Parsha begins immediately after.
Yeah, I understand, Joe, but you and I are answering two different questions. You're answering the question, why did Chazal throw in Amalek here? You're right, your answer is excellent. I'm asking a different question. Why did Chazal have to look for an explanation or justification why Yisro came? I mean, the pasuk itself says he heard that God took us out of Mitzrayim. So my father wants to suggest that in order to appreciate both the success in the battle against Amalek and the Kriya, the division of the water into two, the splitting of the sea, you have to understand something about these two miracles. There's something that's very unique about the two. And in order to understand the case of Yamsuf, he says that you have to understand the pasuk describes that the sea split ligzarim. Ligzarim means into sections. And Chazal say it split into 12 sections, such that each shevet, each tribe went down another pathway. And the Bartanura, that's the super commentary on Mishnayis, and in this case Mishnayis Avos, he says that the walls that separated the different tribes were transparent like glass. And why? Why did they have to be transparent? Says the Bartanura, Kidei sheyiru elu es elu, that the Jews would be able to see one the other. The Jews were eager to see what was happening to their fellow Jews. They were determined that in this dangerous situation that they faced at Yamsuf, they would be calm and they would be collected because they could see their brothers and their sisters of the other Shvatim, their cousins, that were doing well and they were all happy. This is called Achdus. When I care about the next one, I don't care about myself, but my heart goes out about someone else. He says the same trait of Achdus was evinced at the time of the Milchemes Amalek. The enemy... Okay, here we have to open Taka the Chumash. Again, I'll read it to you in English, but I want to see it in Hebrew, Joe, if you don't mind. In Sefer Dvarim, if you could open up to Perek Chaf Hei, that's the very last two psukim in Parshas Kiteitze, which we'll read, I think, when? In about 2 weeks, no? And the Torah describes that the Amalekis were very smart, and they attacked those who were faint and weary.
Yeah. Zachor et asher asa lecha amalek b'derech b'tzeitchem mimitzrayim.
What pasuk are you up to, Theda? What number?
Yud. See, it's another story.
Oh.
18. Oh. Where did you want me? 17. Where did you want me to be?
Yeah, 18 is something called faint and weary. It should say.
Yeah.
Ayei fi yageya. Excellent. Do you see those words? Ayei fi yageya.
Yeah.
Okay.
Ve'ata ayef vi yageya ve'lo
Yare Elokim.
Yare Elokim.
Right. So Rashi says, what does it mean, Ayef v'yageya? What does it mean that the Amalekis attack those who are faint and weary? So Rashi says that it means Chasrei Koach Machmat Chata'am Shehaya Hanan Polta. Now we know that the Anan Yakovo, the clouds of glory, protected the Jewish people. But the clouds of glory spit forth those who were guilty of sin. These weak people were guilty of sin, and therefore the clouds of glory spewed them out, and they were really prime targets for Amalek. So Amalek was very sharp, they understood. The Yalkut, which is a compilation of Midrashim, goes as far as to identify those people who were guilty as Shevet Dan. Shevet Dan was particularly guilty of idol worship. Okay. Now if you could turn to the next page, we'll see something amazing. You know what? Shevet Dan, in this context, is representative of a major portion of our people, unfortunately, today, as we speak. There are deviationists, there are idol worshippers, there are sinners. You know, if you're an Orthodox Jew, you might say, well, there are all sorts of deviant movements, if you know what I'm saying. There's Reconstructionists, there's Reform, and there's others. And the cloud of glory might have rejected them. So why do we have to go into battle against Amalek? These guys are the lowlives, these are the deviationists, these are the idol worshippers and the sinners. They're outside the protection of the Anan Yakovo. So there was a group of people who got up and they said, Moshe Rabbeinu, again, this is my father's imagination, Moshe Rabbeinu, why do we have to exert ourselves, put our lives in danger, put our lives on the line, and fight for the men of Dan, these low idol worshippers? What business do we have with them? If their deviationists and their weakness in faith is why they were rejected or spit forth from the protective clouds of glory, let them die at the hands of Amalek. Why do I have to go out and battle for them? And the answer is Achdus. The answer is that we are dedicated to all of our people as one. And Hashem will wage war, Milchemes Hashem ba'Amalek, Midar Lidar, Midar Dar, every generation. It doesn't matter what the generation is made up of. We have to fight the battle of Amalek, even in a case where Amalekians are attacking those who might be weaker in their observance. Again, if you want, you'll read the next paragraph when you have a chance. This was written in the year 1978. And now I want to share with you. Yeah, go ahead, please. Yeah, Rivka, I haven't heard from you, so it's good to hear.
That fight is more important for unity than hearing. So how is it that punishment is more greater for harming a person's ears than eyes?
That has to do with his ability to function. If he's deaf, it's very hard for him to function in any capacity. Today you'll find, if I'm not mistaken, that blind people could do a heck of a lot of things. We own, from 40 years ago, it's not something that we bought recently, a wicker chair. Have you ever seen it? It's a rocking chair that's made of wicker. And it was made by the blind. The blind are doing a heck of a lot of nice things. In fact, I think...
Well, the deaf is easier. The deaf could make the chair more easily by being able to see.
I'm not sure. I guess we'd have to learn the Gemara Bava Kama to go into detail exactly what a deaf person, at least that back in the day, was capable of doing as an employee and not.
And also a request It seems to me that you need to teach this material in Meir Shearim.
Okay.
Other places.
Okay, good. So first I'm going to teach it in Hungary. What I mean by Hungary is the Chassam Sofer, because I have another Chiddush from the Chassam Sofer. The Chassam Sofer lived in Prešburg in Hungary. And I'm asking you to find a page that looks like this. Mine is chopped up because I have the original.
That 3, 4, number 3.
Yeah, it'll say numbers 3, 4, and 5. Okay. So the Chassam Sofer has an unbelievable revolution here, and he says the following. He says, when there's Achdus, then our enemies are disunited, if there's such a word in English. Can somebody give me a better word? They're splintered, or whatever word you want to use. But if on the opposite end of the spectrum there is divisiveness, oh, that's a good word. If there's divisiveness amongst our people, then they, our enemies, gather together. It's a mirror, it's an opposite image. He says that at the beginning of Megillas Esther, the Jewish people were splintered. And therefore, Haman and Achashverosh got together to plan the destruction of the Jewish people. Later on, Esther says, Lech Knosis Kol HaYehudim. Gather it together in Achdus, in brotherhood. And at that point, there's going to be a split between Achashverosh and Haman. And the Chassam Sofer, only seeing the tip of the iceberg, he has many, many instances in Tanakh to prove this point, that Achdus is the only way that we can achieve Pizur L'Rishayim, divisiveness amongst our enemies, our adversaries. Then he goes on to say, that was in Parshas Lech Lecha, in Parshas Yisro, he writes that Moshe Rabbeinu, the Torah tells us, sat in judgment of the people. He says, what's going on here? The people came in order to study Torah. They had questions. And yet, Vayeshev Moshe Lishpot Es Ha'am, Moshe sat there in judgment. Heim lo bo lefanav elulmo Torah kol hayom. They wanted to study Torah at the feet of Moshe Rabbeinu. However, Moshe Rabbeinu said, wait a minute. I'm not ready to teach you Torah. You're not ready to learn Torah. Why? First, vayeshev Moshe lishpot esar. Terem esek haTorah, says the Chassam. So before you can sit down and learn, we have to smoothen out any of the frictions between one Jew and another. And therefore, b'chol yom al yelishpo b'neim, masha over b'neim, yom esmol lo yashvu chas v'shalom b'pirud lev lo tatzliach torasom. He says, I have to make sure that we're all equal, we're all together, and there's no divisiveness.
This sounds more like Aaron than Moshe.
Correct. Moshe and Aaron actually played symbiotic roles. Moshe Rabbeinu was the one who, in a more kingly kind of way, created Achdus, whereas Aaron was more hands-on. But here I have an amazing story to tell you. There was a Gadol B'Yisrael about 2 centuries ago and more, who wrote many great Sfarim, and he came from a town called Mikkelsberg, which I think is Galicia today, and his name was Rav Mordechai Benet. Anyone who studies Masechta Shabbos can't move without Rav Mordechai Benet's Chidushim, which calls the Magid Avos. But he wrote many, many Sfarim. I have 2 biographies about him. But this story I didn't know. The man was not, when he was not well, he was vacationing, I don't know what the, that's not a good word, in Carlsbad.
Kind of like the wars, you know.
No, Carlsberg is where the spas were.
Yeah, it's one of the wars.
Oh, what's it called? Wars?
Waters.
Oh, waters. Okay, I'm sorry, I didn't hear you. You see, I saw you, but I didn't hear you. That's the problem. Okay. So there, that's where the spas were, the waters were. And unfortunately, he died in that city, far away from Nikolsburg, where they loved him, where he was the Rav in his hometown. Now the name of the town where he was buried, which was just a twin city to Carlsberg, is called Lichtenstadt. I'm probably not pronouncing it the way it should be pronounced. In any event, the Jews in that town jumped on the occasion to bury him in their local cemetery. not 2 hours after he expired, they buried him. And the city of Nicholsburg was up in arms. They wanted to bury him in their own hometown, in their local cemetery. But the people in Liechtenstadt said, well, Kol HaKodem Zocha, whoever gets first dibs, we got first dibs, we took his holy body and we buried him in our local cemetery. You can't unearth him. What's the word in English? Reinter him. So this became a tremendous machlokas and divided two great communities of Israel as to where the great tzaddik Rav Mordechai Benet would be buried. And they decided they would agree to go to the Chasam Sofer and he would make the final decision. The Chasam Sofer himself thought that they should reinter him and bury him in the city of his birth, in the city where he rabbinated and so forth with his beloved people in Nicholsburg. But he hesitated. And he wasn't exactly sure. And as a result, the people of Nicholsburg drop the case. If the Chasam Sofer doesn't give a clear-cut psak, you can't, to upset a great giant by removing his body, you have to have, 100%. It can't be just 90%. A half a year later, the Chasam Sofer writes a tshuva to the courts of Nicholsburg. And he writes that now he came to an absolute certain conclusion, lahatir, to permit Pinuy HaKever, to take the great Rav Mordechai Benet out of his resting place, and to move him and reinter him 6 months later in the city of Nicholsburg. And at that point, that's exactly what they did. At the end of writing this letter, the Chasam Sofer fell asleep. You remember the story? And he had a dream. And in this dream, Rav Mordechai Benet appears to him and says to him that you're doing the right thing. But why is it, asked the Chasam Sofer, that for 6 months I didn't have a clear decision? He says the following: I was punished, and for 6 months I was not buried in my hometown. And why is that? He says the following: there was a kala, an engaged girl, and the chassan wanted to break the engagement. And I, meaning Rav Benet, allowed the chassan to break the engagement. L'nateket hashiduch. Hagam, even though what I did was alpidin, I followed the law, but nevertheless, she was absolutely devastated by this. And the kavod abrios, her self-dignity, was totally lost. She was absolutely devastated. Anochi, says Rav Mordechai Benet in this dream, garamti tsar, I caused such pain and suffering and humiliation for this kala and for her family, that in Shamayim they said, Lo hutzrachti lasos kain, you didn't have to paskin that way. So it's a very paradoxical, sensitive situation. On the one hand, according to the strict law, if you go by the books, the letter of the letter of the law, he was justified. But up in Shemayim, they said he should have had more compassion. And as a result, Hashem said that for 6 months you're going to be buried far away. Vizelcha ha'os. Kidvarai Kanim. Rav Benet says to the Chasam Sofer, I'm going to give you a sign that what I'm telling you is absolutely true. Yelchu yivduku v'yimtzu, ki osa kalash and itakti shiduchera, kvura b'diyuk samuch, l'kivri mamish. He says that when they re-bury me, you will see that right next to my place of burial, you will find the Kala herself. And they woke up I mean, the Chassam Sofer woke up and he sent shluchim, he sent the messengers out, v'nisbarer ki hachalom nachon, that this dream was absolutely true. And therefore, the Chassam Sofer wrote the tshuva to allow. So imagine, a man is found guilty in Shamayim for not being sensitive enough towards this young girl. Okay, my friends, we will stop here. Anyone who's interested, I'm going to give a parasha class now. I never gave one at night, so this is new to me. And I think, Theta and Joe, you'll be here for one more class, if my calendar... Oh, it's two. And Yossel, you're on your way back? Or?
No.
Oh, so maybe we'll have you, Joel,
next Wednesday,
Rivka.
I should have a problem.
So you know what? Let me ask one question.
Next Tuesday.
Is there anybody who can come on Wednesday of next week instead of Tuesday? All right, so you don't know. I'll tell you why. I have to have a wedding next Tuesday.
But...
Okay. It doesn't... Yeah, don't bother yourself. For right now, we're not changing the date of the shiur. We'll keep it as it is. If anybody wants to add their name to this list, which I passed around last time, just to add your email, because in this case, I really could use it, just in case, you know, I get pressured to go to this
wedding. Underlying question.
So, Joe, let me just do one last thing. Just make sure there's no one waiting outside. Because, again, this is the first time I ever gave a kumash about this. Okay, we're good, Joe.
My time's up. Next week, Tuesday's better, but I could come Wednesday.
Okay.
Okay, so let us know, right? I'm sorry, I can't stay.
Right now, it's Tuesday, okay?
Does it change?
Yeah.
Okay, thank you.
So great rabbi dies. He's far away from his hometown.
Right.
This is not a time when they can put him on a plane and fly him back to his hometown.
Right.
He's supposed to bury him, you know, within a day. Right? So the people, the Jewish community in the adjacent to Carlsbad said, "We're here. We have a cemetery. You're going to put him in a wagon 14 days to go back to his hometown?"
Right.
I'm trying to understand why that was deemed to be wrong on their
part. So, again, I don't know all the details of the case. And I'm not saying they did the wrong thing. I'm just saying...
Because it seemed to me they did the right thing. It was the wrong thing to say, all right, we'll put
but him where will, put where will, and where will be the ultimate resting place? In other words, do the people in Nicholsburg have a legal claim that...
Have him dug up.
Exactly. That's really the issue.
I thought it was a chutzpah.
Really?
I
personally, again, everybody has their own feelings. I side with the people of Nicholsburg. I mean, the man dedicated his whole life.
Yeah.
Oh, you're with me on that, yes.
Yeah. How would they have to put this up?
And yet the Chassam Sofer was hesitant, and he himself, the Chassam Sofer, didn't understand why he was hesitant.
I mean,
he had no logical reason to be, he should have given the psak. Took him 6 months till finally he picks up a pen, writes a tshuva, and says, "I have no doubt about it. Now I see the clarity of this." And so the answer is, he had a dream. And Rav Mordechai Benedict appeared to him in a dream. But what I wanted to bring out here is, you know, Theta was asking about, you know, can we disagree with each other and still respect each other, and I think the answer lies in this concept of achdus, which he says, the Peleoid says, is the pillar of the world. If we can work together in a cooperative spirit, we respect each other, we can have disagreements. Again, we have to find the modus vivendi, how to reconcile those disagreements, because basically the Peleoid wants to say that all of society functions based on this achdus. I want to read to you one more line before I let you go. He says that, you remember the Dor HaFlaga? So the pasuk says about the Dor HaFlaga, you know, they wanted to build a tower and fight against God. But they were unified.
Right? They were totally unified.
And that's what the pasuk goes out of its way to say, that they were unified. Again, these low people who want to fight against God. Hain, says the pasuk, Am Echad V'Sofa Achas L'Kulam. Says the Peleoids, why did the Torah have to go out of its way to be so explicit about the fact that they spoke one language and they were one nation? The answer is that they were a powerful force because Shahayu Ba'achdus, because they gathered together in unity. And here Hashem had to use a very severe Midas Hadid. And basically, how did he foil their attempt?
By making them disunified, exactly. By changing, having 43 different languages.
Hava Nerda Vinivla Sham Sfasa. The whole root of the problem is that they have one Safa, so we're going to make them into many different Safot. Shalo Yishmu Ish Sfat Reyeu. Kidei Sheikonis Machlokas Beineu. Once it's Machlokas, now the Midas Hadin, justice can be meted out. But it's unbelievable. As long as they were together, when they spoke the same language, says the Pelioids, the Midas Hadin could not harm them. They were like protected. It's an amazing concept. The bulk of what he says in the rest of this presentation is he wants to prove how successful almost any enterprise could be if there's Achdus. Maybe we'll get a chance to talk about this. Officially, our topic for next week is Achil and Shasir, right? Eat, drink, and be merry. And
eat, drink, and be question mark.
Right, and be spiritual, I guess, or something, right? Because he's interested in being spiritual.
Whatever
right?
Pele Yosef said.
Correct. So that I can give it to you now, or you can wait till next week.
Rabbi, I sent it to you.
Yeah, how did I get it? Do you think I'm a? You think I had a dream like the Ksav Sofer? I know it because you gave it to me. But the one after that, I don't think yes. Either I didn't send it to you,
you
or you didn't
send it to me.
Right. So the one afterwards, no, Shofar is for a different class. That's yes. My Wednesday night Shia. That's a Gemara Shia. But no, the next one after Achila Shasir, I should have it here on my desk. Oh yeah, here I have it. After Achila Shasir, which is pages. And then the next one after that is Orchim, guests. There's a whole section about how to fulfill the mitzvah of beautiful section. So that's 2 weeks down the line. I think that's September 4th, I think.
We'll be gone.
That's what I'm saying. That's what I'm telling you, that I think you're here for one more week. That's, I think. I'm not sure. You'll check it out on the calendar. I get very confused. What day in August are we up to? I should have it on my phone.
Today is the 14th.
Tuesday is the 21st.
Next week is the 21st. Oh, so maybe...